The following you are about to hear may seem strange and bizarre, but it is our intention to bring you only documented truth. So-called modern communism is apparently the same hypocritical and deadly world conspiracy to destroy civilization that was founded by the secret order of the Illuminati. The conspirators thereupon conceived the plan for the future of supplementing the long-established secret conspiracy through an unremitting public campaign for victims among the ignorant of all nations, has failed to grasp the staggering realities of this conspiracy within the conspiracy. A revolutionary attempt to overthrow all governments and all religions in order to enslave the whole human race under a super one-world government ruled by satanic despotism. Lone voices have been raised to alert the world to the imminent dangers from this satanic conspiracy of the forces of darkness.
This voice is added to the millions around the world who seek the truth and who speak the truth. This is the Iconoclast Report with Carolyn Harris. Prepare to have your paradigm shattered. Welcome, everybody, to the June 27th edition of the Iconoclast Report. I am, of course, am your host, Carolyn Harris, and today we are going to be talking about public education, training generations for slavery. Well, most of us went to public school, and we are not better off for it. Many of you listening today realize that public education and public schools are really nothing more than government indoctrination centers. Of course, the curriculum, methods, means, and modes differ from country to country, but the fact remains a public school, and now many private and parochial schools, accept federal funding and are therefore beholden to the central government to a degree, be it completely or only slightly. Because of this, the government can not only dictate what is taught, but how it is taught, subjects or topics that are verboten, and what is considered sufficient capability or knowledge on any grade level or subject matter. This control is absolutely critical to those who are dedicated to completing what they call the great work of bringing about a new world order. Without access to young children and teens and the ability to program with a very carefully crafted illusions, they could not accomplish their goal. Well, today we're going to learn about the history of education, the players involved in creating a public education system in the Western world, their philosophy, their goal, in their own words, the illusion that they're trying to create and maintain, as well as what the effect of public education has had upon civilization, the foundation of which is the family unit. This information will be highly disturbing to some, especially those who work within the education system. But it must be understood that there are many well-intentioned, good, and decent people who work either directly or indirectly in the education industrial complex. And they, or you, of course, have children's best interests at heart. Well, this show is, and this information is not, I repeat, not a condemnation of you personally. Well, this program is dedicated to bringing the hard truths to the fore so that we can have the facts and therefore are better able to make genuinely informed decisions about our lives in as many areas as we can. Without knowledge, and that is truthful information, we're at the mercy of others who merely parrot propaganda, and we're trapped within the paradigms that are created and given to us as the gospel truth. Well, the truth is that those paradigms, those traditions, those cultural norms are nothing more than strings attached to us to make us dance like marionettes. That is the awful truth, I know. But dedication to those hard truths require that we must stare truth in the face, no matter how unsettling, disturbing, or how horrible it may be. We must, absolutely must, know the truth, because the truth will truly set us free. And we're all about freedom. Personal responsibility. We'll be right back after this very quick break.
Hey, folks. folks, I've got a question for you. Do you force yourself out of bed each morning and drag throughout the day? Do you grab for that sugar pick-me-up only to later crash and feel even more tired? Well, I've got the solution for you. Put a zip in your day and zap your appetite. Reclaim your get-up-and-go with Zip and Zap. Let me tell you what you'll notice in immediate benefits. It ramps up your workouts. Well, if you work out. Turns off your hunger, elevates your mood, helps you to resist fattening foods, and gives you a smooth flow of energy with no crash. The testimonials? Colin in Illinois lost 30 pounds in 8 weeks, didn't work out. Susie in Missouri, 10 pounds in 20 days, she didn't work out. Anna in California did work out and went from a size 14 to a size 4 in 90 days. If you want results like this, working out or not, order Zip and Zap now and also ask about Lametco International's first line of defense products. Tell him Michael Herzog sent you. Call 1-800-933-2565. That's 1-800-933-2565.
You invest. You buy insurance. You wear your seatbelt. You do things to ensure your family's future and protection. But why? Just in case? With the current state of affairs, ask yourself, am I ready? Preparation starts at SurvivalGearSource.com. SurvivalGearSource.com has a huge selection of vital products. Emergency survival kits, gas masks, MREs, products for pet care, your car, home, office, and school. Protect against pandemics, all natural disasters, and terror attacks that can happen at any time. If you're not prepared, the last place you want to be is standing in a FEMA line. Invest in your future now. Visit SurvivalGearSource.com or call 877-231-1925. That's 877-231-1925. SurvivalGearSource.com. That's SurvivalGearSource.com. 877-231-1925. SurvivalGearSource.com. Prepare for tomorrow now, and for a free gift on your first order, enter coupon code ORACLE at checkout. Don't forget, preparation starts at SurvivalGearSource.com.
Hey folks, it's Tony Pax from the Animal Farm Radio Show, and I want to tell you about the company Totally Wicked. Totally Wicked is the leading online worldwide supplier of electronic cigarettes. An electronic cigarette, or e-cigarette, is an alternative to smoked tobacco products such as cigarettes, cigars, or pipes. It is a battery-powered device that provides inhaled doses of nicotine by delivering a vaporized liquid nicotine solution. In addition to nicotine delivery, this vapor also provides a flavor and physical sensation similar to that of inhaled tobacco smoke, even though no tobacco smoke or combustion is actually involved in its operation. Totally Wicked's products not only help a person to regulate their nicotine intake and creates a vapor resembling smoke, but it also looks like a cigarette, thereby helping the user with the psychological and physical habit of holding a regular cigarette. To find out more about the great products that Totally Wicked has to offer, please visit totallywicked-eliquid.com or email them at info@totallywicked-eliquid.com.
The question of how and why the United Nations is the crux of the great conspiracy to destroy the sovereignty of the United States and the enslavement of the American people within a UN one-world dictatorship is a complete and unknown mystery to the vast majority of the American people. The reason for this unawareness of the frightening danger to our country and to the entire free world is simple. The masterminds behind this great conspiracy have absolute control.
We are talking about public education and how it trains generations for slavery. Well, we can't understand what's going on today unless we understand the history of education. It has changed throughout the centuries. It has gone from one philosophy all the way across the spectrum to another philosophy and flipped back and forth a few times since then. I'm going to be, reading from a document entitled The History of Education, edited by Robert Giuseppe, okay? And that is, of course, up in my library, the New World Order Library. You can get there by going to www.nwolibrary.com and click on the library button. It's open all the time and no registration required. You will find these documents that I'm citing today in the public education section. It says, with the gradual rise of more complex civilizations in the river valleys of Egypt and Babylonia, knowledge became too complicated to transmit directly from person to person and from generation to generation. To be able to function in complex societies, man needed some way of accumulating, recording, and preserving his cultural heritage. So, with the rise of free trade, government and formal religion came the invention of writing about 3100 BC. Because firsthand experience in everyday living could not teach skills such as writing and reading, a place devoted exclusively to learning, the school appeared. And with the school appeared a group of adults specially designated as teachers, the scribes of the court and the priests of the temple. Children were either in the vast majority who continued to learn exclusively by informal apprenticeship or the tiny minority who received formal schooling. This method of learning was memorization. And the motivation was the fear of harsh physical discipline. On an ancient Egyptian clay tablet discovered by archaeologists, the child had written, quote, "Thou didst beat me, and knowledge entered my head." Of the ancient peoples of the Middle East, the Jews, or the Hebrews, were the most insistent that all children, regardless of class, be educated. In the first century AD, the historian Flavius Josephus wrote, quote, "We take most pains of all with the instruction of the children and esteem of the observance of the laws and the piety corresponding with them, the most important affair of our whole life." The Jews, or Hebrews, established elementary schools where boys from about 6 to 13 years of age probably learned rudimentary mathematics and certainly learned reading and writing. The main concern was the study of the first five books of the Old Testament, the Pentateuch, and the precepts of the oral tradition that had grown up around them. And many of you out there know that the oral tradition came from Babylon, and that was called the Babylonian Talmud once it was written down in that form. Okay, continuing on, at age 13, brighter boys could continue their studies as disciples of a rabbi, the master or teacher. So vital was the concept of instruction for the Jews or Hebrews that the synagogues existed at least as much for instruction as for worship. Now, we go to ancient Greece. The goal of education in the Greek city-states was to prepare the child for adult activities as a citizen. The nature of city-states varied greatly, and this is also true of the education they considered appropriate. The goal of education in Athens, a democratic city-state, was to produce citizens trained in the arts of both peace and war. In Athens, the ideal citizen was a person educated in the arts of both peace and war, and this made both schools and exercise fields necessary. Other than requiring 2 years of military training that began at age 18, the state left parents to educate their sons as they saw fit. The schools were private, but the tuition was low enough so that even the poorest citizens could afford to send their children for at least a few years. Boys attended elementary school from the time they were about age 6 or 7 until they were 13 or 14. But it was literature that was at the heart of their schooling. The national epic poems of the Greeks, Homer's Odyssey and Iliad, were a vital part of life of the Athenian people. As soon as their pupils could write, the teachers dictated passages from Homer for them to take down, memorize, and later act out. Teachers and pupils also discussed the feats of the Greek heroes described by Homer. At 13 or 14, formal education of the poorer boys probably ended and was followed by apprenticeship at a trade. The wealthier boys continued their education under the tutelage of philosopher teachers. Until about 390 BC, there were no permanent schools and no formal courses for such higher education. Socrates, for example, wandered around Athens, stopping here or there to hold discussions with people about all sorts of things pertaining to the conduct of man's life. But gradually, as groups of students attached themselves to one teacher or another, permanent schools were established. It was in such schools that Plato, Isocrates, and Aristotle taught. The boys who attended these schools fell into more or less two groups. Those who wanted learning for its own sake studied with philosophers like Plato, who taught such subjects as geometry, astronomy, harmonics, the mathematical theory of music, and arithmetic. Those who wanted training for public life studied with philosophers like Isocrates, who taught primarily oratory and rhetoric. In democratic Athens, such training was appropriate and necessary because power rested with the men who had the ability to persuade their fellow senators to act. Most Athenian girls had a primarily domestic education. In ancient Rome, it was a little bit different. Actually, Greek influence on Roman education had begun about a century before the conquest. Originally, most if not all Roman boys' education took place at home. If the father himself were educated, the boy would learn to read and learn Roman law, history, and customs. When the boy was older, he sometimes prepared himself for public life by a kind of apprenticeship to one of the orators of the time. He thus learned the arts of oratory firsthand by listening to the debates in the Senate and in the public forum. The element introduced into Roman education by the Greeks was book learning. When they were 6 or 7 years old, boys and sometimes girls of all classes could be sent by their parents to the Ludus Publius, the elementary school, where they studied reading, writing, and counting. At age 12 or 13, the boys of the upper class attended a quote-unquote grammar school where they learned Latin or Greek or both and studied grammar or literature. Grammar consisted of the study of declensions and conjugations and the analysis of verbal forms. Both Greek and Latin literature were studied. The teacher would read the work and then lecture on it while the students took notes that they later memorized. At age 16, the boys who wanted training for public service went on to study public speaking at the rhetoric schools. The graded arrangement of schools established in Rome by the middle of the 1st century BC ultimately spread throughout the Roman Empire. It continued until the fall of the empire in the 5th century AD. Now, although deeply influenced by Greek education, Roman education was nonetheless quite different. For most Greeks, the end of education was to produce a good citizen, and a good citizen meant a well-rounded individual. The goal of Roman education was the same, but for the Romans, a good citizen meant an effective speaker. The result was that they disregarded such non-utilitarian Greek studies as science, philosophy, music, dancing, and gymnastics, basing their education instead on literature and oratory. When we come back, we'll talk about the Middle Ages. Stay tuned.
How would you like to cook any meal using no electricity or gas and cook your meals off the grid? Well, now you can, thanks to the Survival Oven. The Survival Oven is the most amazing off-grid solar oven that can cook anything that a conventional oven can without the energy bills. By condensing sunlight, the Survival Oven can produce temps up to 350 degrees, cook delicious and nutritious meals, sterilize water, dehydrate food, and so much more, all at zero operating costs. The Survival Oven can be used year-round, even in the coldest sub-zero temperatures, and is a must for emergency preparedness and even everyday use. Visit SurvivalOven.com to get your very own Survival Oven. Order the Survival Oven now, and we'll get you started with 2 cooking pots and a recipe booklet absolutely free. At less than 10 pounds, you can take Survival Solar Oven with you anywhere. Call 877-642-1553 or go to SurvivalOven.com. That's SurvivalOven.com.
Loan modifications don't work. At least not without some leverage from a forensic audit by mortgage fraud examiners. Have your payments skyrocketed under an adjustable rate mortgage? Have you been laid off or had your hours cut? Are balloon payments coming due? Congress and the White House are pinning their hopes on homeowners renegotiating their mortgages to stop the housing crisis. Trouble is, the banks are saying no 80% of the time. That's where Mortgage Fraud Examiners comes in. They perform forensic loan audits and appraisals to find legal deficits in your mortgage. They estimate that up to 85% of all mortgages have legal problems. Banks and lenders suddenly start cooperating if faced with a lawsuit for violating lending laws or appraisal fraud. You could gain some powerful ammunition to use for Mortgage Fraud Examiners. Get more information at www.mortgagefraudexaminers.com or call 800-540-EXAM. That's 800-540-3926.
Now on DVD, my newest documentary film, The Secret Rite, Volume 1. I'm Josh Reeves, and for the almost 2 years, I have researched the secretive right-wing group known as the Council for National Policy. This film explores for the first time the hidden hand that controls the religious and military aims of the American right wing, with such topics as Iran-Contra, the John Birch Society, eugenics, the Vatican controllers, Christian Zionists, the Bohemian Grove, the Patriot Movement, and more. More powerful than the Council on Foreign Relations, more secretive than the Bilderberg Group, The Secret Rite Volume 1 goes where no other film has dared to go. Get your copy today at secretrightmovie.com. That's www.secretrightmovie.com and find out what you haven't been told about the New World Order. Decoding the New World Order, past, present, and future, Monday through Friday, 11 to 3 p.m. Central Standard Time, The Global Reality with Josh Reeves.
There's something else going on here, and they haven't told you the whole story. You are the stock in the corporation, so they give your body to the bank in Switzerland. So your body now becomes stock of the corporation, all you need to pay, because you are a money maker.
All right, we're talking about public education and the history, and we were talking about Roman education right before the break. Well, when the empire fell, the education that was originally intended to train orators for the Roman Senate became the model for European education and dominated it until the 20th century. Now, moving on to the Middle Ages, the invading Germanic tribes that moved into the civilized world of the West and all but destroyed ancient culture provided virtually no formal education for their young. In the early Middle Ages, the elaborate Roman school system had disappeared. Mankind in the 5th century Europe might as well have reverted almost to the level of primitive education had it not been for the medieval church, which preserved what little Western learning had survived the collapse of the Roman Empire. In the drafty, inhospitable corridors of church schools, the lamp of learning continued to burn low, though it flickered badly. Cathedral, monastic, and palace schools were operated by the clergy in most parts of Western Europe. The students were future or present members of the clergy, though a few lay students were trained to be clerks. These schools taught students to read Latin so that they could copy and thereby preserve and perpetuate the writings of the church fathers. Students learned the rudiments of mathematics so that they could calculate the dates of the religious festivals, and they practiced singing so that they could take part in church services. Schools were ungraded, and a 6-year-old and a 16-year-old, or an adult for that matter, sometimes sharing the same bench. Medieval education can be understood better if one realizes that for thousands of years, childhood as it is known today literally did not exist. No psychological distinction was made between child and adult. The medieval school was not really intended for children. Rather, it was a kind of vocational school for clerks and clergymen. A 7-year-old in the Middle Ages became an integral part of the adult world, absorbing adult knowledge and doing a man's work as best he could during what today would be the middle years of elementary education. It was not until the 18th century that childhood was recognized, not until the 20th that it began to be understood. In the 12th and 13th centuries, toward the end of the Middle Ages, saw the rise of universities. The university curriculum in about 1200 consisted of what were then called the 7 liberal arts. These were grouped in 2 divisions. The first was the preparatory trivium, grammar, rhetoric, and logic. The second, more advanced division was the quadrivium, arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy. Like the Romans, the scholars of the Middle Ages took over the content of Greek education and adapted it to their own culture. The traditional subjects were clouded with religious assumptions. Astronomy, for example, was permeated with astrology, and arithmetic was full of mystical meaning. Medieval education had its problems. There were many dropouts. The influence of the church sometimes drugged rather than enlivened the mind, and scholars were often expected to accept the unreason and the unproved. Materials were few and poor. Many university libraries had fewer than 100 volumes. Because books were so scarce, lessons had to be dictated and then memorized. Nevertheless, medieval schooling ended with a long era of barbarism, launched the careers of able men, and sharpened the minds and tongues of the thoughtful and ambitious students. For youngsters of the aristocracy in the Middle Ages or of the 13th century, there was a chivalric education. This was kind of secondary education that young men received while living in the homes of nobles or at court. It included some poetry, national history, heraldry, manners and customs, physical training, dance, a little music, and of course battle skills. Chivalric secular education was governed by a code rather than a curriculum. boys of the lower classes could learn a trade through apprenticeships in a craftsman shop. So they were not allowed the chivalric education. Moving on to the Renaissance period, the essence of the Renaissance, which began in Italy in the 14th century and spread to northern European countries in the 15th and 16th centuries, was a revolt against the narrowness and otherworldliness of the Middle Ages. For inspiration, the early Renaissance humanists turned to the ideals expressed in the literature of ancient Greece. Like the Greeks, they wanted education to develop man's intellectual, spiritual, and physical powers for the enrichment of life. The actual content of the humanists' quote-unquote liberal education was not so much different from that of medieval education. To the seven liberal arts, the humanists added history and physical games and exercises. Humanist education was primarily enlivened by the addition of Greek to the curriculum and an emphasis on the content of Greek and Roman literature. After nearly 1,000 years, grammar was at last studied, not as an end in itself, but because it gave access to the vital content of literature. In keeping with their renewed interest in and respect for nature, the humanists also gradually purged astronomy of many of the distortions of astrology. Now, the reason I mentioned humanists and the Middle Ages, we are going to get into that subject in the second hour. Continuing on with this document, the history of education, it says, along with the changed attitudes towards the goal and content of education, in a few innovative schools came the first signs of a change in attitude towards educational methods. Rather than bitter medicine to be forced down the students' throats, education was to be exciting, pleasant, and fun. The school that most closely embodied these early Renaissance ideals was founded in Mantua, Italy, in 1423 by Vittorino da Feltra. Even the name of his school, Casa Giocosa, which means happy house, broke with the medieval tradition of cheerless institutions in which grammar, along with the Holy Writ, was flogged into the learner's memory. The school served children from age 6 to youths in their mid-20s. People studied history, philosophy, arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy, but the basis of the curriculum was the study of Greek and Roman literature. The humanist ideal did not affect the lower classes, however, who remained as ignorant as they had been in the Middle Ages. Its impact was appreciable, however, on the secondary education that was provided for the upper classes. This is not to say that there was a proliferation of happy houses. Unlike Vittorino's school, the other Latin grammar schools that introduced Greek and Roman literature into the curriculum soon shifted the emphasis, as the Romans had done, from the study of the content of the literature to the form of the language. The physical development, so important to the early humanist ideal of the well-rounded man, found no place in the curriculum. Instead, the joy of learning, there was harsh, repressive discipline. And then, of course, we move on to the Reformation period. The degeneration and practice of the early humanists' educational goals and methods continued during the 16th century Reformation and its aftermath. The religious conflict that dominated men's thoughts also dominated the humanistic curriculum of the Protestant secondary schools. The Protestants' need to defend their new religion resulted in further sacrifice of pagan contact and more emphasis on drill and the mechanics of Greek and Latin languages. In actual practice, then, the humanistic ideal deteriorated into the narrowness and otherworldliness that the original humanists had opposed. The Protestants emphasized the need for universal education and established elementary vernacular schools in Germany where the children of the poor could learn reading, writing, and religion. This innovation was to have far-reaching effects on education in the Western world. Well, now we move on, of course, to the 17th and 18th century in Europe. The vast majority of schools remained in a state of stagnation during the 17th and 18th centuries. By and large, teachers were incompetent and the discipline cruel. The learning methods were drill and memorization of words, sentences, and facts that the children often did not understand. Most members of the lower classes got no schooling whatsoever, and what some did get was at the hands of teachers who were often themselves barely educated. We'll be right back on the other side. Stay tuned, everybody. Listen to the Iconic Class Report with Sarah Parent.
You are now listening to the Oracle Broadcasting Network, the home of cutting-edge talk radio.
Aerial spray, chemtrails, the modified atmosphere, heavy metals and pesticides, carcinogens and chemical fibers all falling from the sky. You have a choice to keep your body clean. Detoxify with microplant powder from hempusa.org or call 908-691-2608. It's odorless and tasteless and used in any liquid or food. Protect your family now with microplant powder. Cleaning out heavy metals, parasites, and toxins. Order it now for daily intake and stock it now for long-term storage. Visit hempusa.org or call 908-691-2608 today.
Of the 3 million plus edible food plants that grow on Earth, no other single plant can compare with the nutritional value of the powder, seeds, and oil of the hemp plant. At hempusa.org, we ship worldwide these nutritional products with free shipping to the U.S. and Canada. At hempusa.org, we want to educate our listeners that edible hemp is not marijuana and is certified THC-free. Our powder is 50% protein and does not contain gluten. Gluten impairs the cells from absorbing nutrients. This nutrient-dense food can be stored up to 5 years when vacuum-packed and is priced affordably to be used as a storable food. HempUSA.org is a bulk shipper starting with 5 pounds and up. To allow this food to work for you, call 908-691-2608 or go to HempUSA.org and order today. The body will react and heal itself given the proper nutrition. This superfood will be your greatest asset. So try it today, store it today, and change your life. Call 908-691-2608 or order from hempusa.org.
The First Amendment in the Bill of Rights limits the government's power by ensuring the freedom of speech and preserving the rights of the people. Every day that passes, our rights gradually slip away. It's time to take a stand and let the government know we're tired of losing our rights. LibertyStickers.com will allow you to express your rights and allow millions of people to see you stand up for what you believe in. LibertyStickers.com carries the largest selection of bumper stickers online, ranging from political to humorous, and is your number one source for Ron Paul for President stickers. As always, you can find your favorite stickers that protest the war and the president. Don't see what you're looking for? Liberty Stickers will custom make stickers that will let you get your message across for all Americans to see. Go to LibertyStickers.com and see pre-made stickers that will get everyone talking. That's LibertyStickers.com or call 877-873-9626. Liberty Stickers, the world's most dangerous stickers.
Well, what an appropriate quote. And that is what public school is actually all about, is to get people to love their servitude. We were talking about the 17th century in education. In the secondary Latin grammar schools and the universities, the linguistic narrowness and otherworldliness of classical studies persisted. By the 17th century, the study of Latin removed students even further from real life than it had in the 16th, because Latin had ceased to be the language of commerce or the exclusive language of religion. In the 17th century, it also slowly ceased to be the exclusive language of scholarly discourse. Yet, most humanist schools made no provision for studying the vernacular and clung to Latin because it was thought to train the mind. The scientific movement, with its skeptical inquiring spirit that began to permeate the Western schools in the 17th century, was successfully barred from both the Catholic and Protestant schools, which continued to emphasize classical linguistic studies. One of the educational pioneers of great stature was John, or Johann Amos Comenius. Effective education, Comenius insisted, must take into account the nature of the child. His own observation of children led him to the conclusion that they were not miniature adults. He characterized the schools, which treated them as if they were, as, quote, the slaughterhouses of minds and places where minds are fed on words. Comenius believed that understanding comes, quote, not in the mere learning the names of things, but in the actual perception of the things themselves, end quote. Education should begin, therefore, with the child's observation of actual objects or, if not the objects themselves, models or pictures of them. The practical result of this theory was Comenius's Orbis Pictus, which means the world in pictures, the first and, for a long time, the only textbooks in the Western world that had illustrations for children to look at. And although the ideas on which it was based were at first ridiculed, Comenius's book was widely used by children for about 200 years. In the 17th century, philosophers, too, were beginning to develop theories of learning that reflected the new scientific reliance on first-hand observation. One of those men whose theories had the greatest impact on education was the English philosopher John Locke. According to Locke, who did not originate this idea but gave impetus to it, the mind at birth is a blank tablet, or tabula rasa. That is, it has no innate God-given knowledge, but it does have a number of powers or faculties, such as perceiving, discriminating, comparing, thinking, and recalling. Locke believed that knowledge comes when these faculties are exercised upon the raw material of sense impressions received from objects in the external world. Once the mind has passively received such sense impressions, its faculties go to work, discriminating among and comparing them, sifting and sorting them until they take shape as knowledge. One aspect of Locke's theory, the notion that the mind is made up of faculties, was interpreted to mean that the function of schooling was to train the various mental faculties. Latin and mathematics, for example, were thought to be especially good for strengthening reasoning and memory. This idea clung to educational practice well into the 20th century, long after faculty psychology had been proven invalid. The more significant aspect of the theory, in terms of educational reform, was the insistence upon first-hand experience with its implicit protest against mere book learning of the Middle Ages and the humanists. If the raw material of knowledge comes from the impressions made upon the mind by natural objects, then education cannot function without objects. Eventually, the effect of this part of the theory was reflected in the introduction into schools of pictures, models, field trips, and other manifestations of education's increased respect for first-hand observation. By the mid-19th century, it had become fashionable to introduce into schools objects that provided first-hand sense impressions and that filled out, supplemented, and gave interest to abstract book learning. The materials and methods of traditional book learning were not radically revised, however, for another 75 years. So, of course, we go to the 18th century. It was the delayed shockwaves of the ideas of an 18th century Frenchman that were to crack the foundations of education in the 20th century and cause their virtual upheaval in the United States. The man was Jean-Jacques Rousseau. The child, as Rousseau saw him, unfolds or develops intellectually, physically, and emotionally, much like a plant. He believes, moreover, that the child is innately good, but that all social institutions, including schools, are evil, distorting the child into their own image. He doubted, therefore, that there should be formal schools at all. Whether there were or not, however, he believed that the aim of education should be the natural development of the learner. Rousseau's observations and the educational ramifications were a complete reversal of the educational theories and practices of the 1700s. The prevailing theory was that the child differs from an adult in the quantity of his mind. The child presumably is born with the same but weaker mental faculties as the adult. To bring these faculties up to an adult level, education must cultivate them through exercise, that is, through drill and memorization. Rousseau, however, believed that the child differs from the adult in the quality of his mind, which successively unfolds in different stages of growth. We are always looking for the man and the child, he said, without thinking what he is before he becomes a man. Children, observed Rousseau, are always in motion. Sedentary life is injurious. From age 2 to 12, therefore, Rousseau envisioned the cultivation of the body and the senses, not the intellect. When the youngster's intellect begins to develop at about 12 or 15, he can begin to study of such things as science and geography. The study, however, should not begin with an organized body of abstract knowledge, but with the things that interest the child and the world around him. He must not learn by memorizing, but by firsthand experience. He is not to learn science, he is to find it out for himself, Rousseau said. Only when he was 15 should book learning begin. So much for the entire Latin school, if one accepted Rousseau. Rousseau also attacked the teaching methods of the time. The theory of mental faculties recognized no innate differences among children. It was thought that children are born with the same faculties, and that the differences among them depend on their education, that is, on the amount of exercise their faculties receive. For Rousseau, such exercise stunts, quote, the true gifts of nature. Since Rousseau believed that the child is innately good and that the aim of education should be his natural development, there was little for the teacher to do except stand aside and watch. Rousseau's overemphasis on the individuality and freedom of the child and his underemphasis of the needs of the child as a social being represent a reaction against the repressive educational practices of the time. Those who were influenced by Rousseau tried to create schools that would provide a controlled environment in which natural growth could take place and, at the same time, be guided by society and the person of the teacher. Ironically, shortly after Rousseau's death, Prussia became the first modern state to create a centrally controlled school system. For more than a century, it operated on the principles almost diametrically opposed to those of Rousseau. Now, to get into education in America, we have to start with colonial America. While the schools that the colonists established in the 17th centuries in New England, Southern, and Middle colonies differed from one another, each reflected a concept of schooling that had been left behind in Europe. Most poor children learned through apprenticeship and had no formal schooling at all. Those who did go to elementary school were taught reading, writing, arithmetic, and religion. Learning consisted of memorizing, which was stimulated by whipping. The secondary school, attended by the wealthier children, was, as in most of Europe, the Latin grammar school. The teachers were no better prepared, and perhaps even less so than the teachers in Europe. Harvard College, which traces its history back to 1636, had its primary purpose of training of Latin school graduates for the ministry. Like most of the colleges in Europe, its curriculum was humanist. Most of the books used in the elementary and secondary schools were also used in Europe. Bibles, Psalters, Latin and Greek texts, Comenius' Orbis Pictus, and the Hornbook, which was widely used in England at the end of the 16th century. Not really a book at all. The Hornbook was a paddle-shaped board. A piece of parchment and later paper with a lesson written on it was attached to the board and covered with a transparent sheet of horn to keep it clean. The first basic textbook, called the New England Primer, was America's own contribution to education. From 1690 until the beginning of the 19th century, its purpose was to teach both religion and reading. A child learning the letter A, for example, also learned that, quote, in Adam's fall we sinned all, end quote. As in Europe, then, the schools of the colonies were strongly influenced by religion. This was particularly true of the schools in the New England area, which had been settled by Puritans and other English religious dissenters, like the Protestants of the Reformation, who established vernacular elementary schools in Germany in the 16th century. The Puritans sought to make education universal. They took the first steps towards government-supported universal education in the colonies. In 1642, Puritan Massachusetts passed a law requiring that every child be taught to read. We'll get right back into it on the other side. Stay tuned, everybody. Hour two is coming up after this last segment.
Are you one of the people who think, I have plenty of time, nothing's ever going to happen bad to me? Do you believe that when your cupboards are bare, our corporate-controlled government will jump right in to feed you and yours? Do you have at least a year's supply of food for your family? This is Kurt, the armchair survivalist, heard on this network. Survival Enterprises sells real food, canned for long-term storage. Beef, chicken, turkey, bacon, butter, cheese, eggs, freeze-dried fruits and vegetables, Mountain House freeze-dried meals, MREs, a full nutritional line, the British Birkfeld water filter, and more. If you want to prepare now, go to beforeitstoolate.us. That's beforeitstoolate.us. or call 1-800-753-1981. That's 1-800-753-1981. Or you can put your head in the sand and be just another sheeple in the corporate-controlled flock. But remember, those who don't learn from history are bound to repeat it.
How would you like to finally be debt-free without paying another cent to creditors and not have to file bankruptcy? DebtCrisisSolutions.com can help free you from the debt trap. This is not a debt settlement program which has tax consequences or debt consolidation. With our program, there are no more payments to creditors or collectors. We will help restore your credit history, protect your property, prevent paycheck garnishments, and preserve your bank account. We also provide mortgage modification services which can lower your mortgage payments without refinancing. If you're facing foreclosure or are in the foreclosure process, we can help. Finally, proven debt solutions that work for the people. Become debt-free in 90 days. Doing nothing doesn't make the debt go away. Call Debt Crisis Solutions today and speak to an advisor absolutely free. Call 718-615-0123. That's 718-615-0123. Or visit them online at DebtCrisisSolutions.com. That's DebtCrisisSolutions.com today.
PureBulk.com has more than 120 nutritional products, super antioxidants, amino acids, and herbal extracts, including advanced life extension nutrition. Find great products like atomic iodine, oil of oregano, spirulina algae, niacin, performance amino acids, herbal extracts, skincare, and heart health nutrition. PureBulk.com products have no fillers, no additives, no hype, and no fancy retail packaging. Just the highest quality bulk nutrition at wholesale pricing. You can also save 50 to 90% off retail nutritional prices when buying bulk wholesale powders and capsules. Shop securely online at purebulk.com or call 406-251-3270. That number again, 406-251-3270. Use the coupon code iodine and receive a 1 gram atomic iodine sample with any order. That's a 150-day RDA supply of atomic iodine absolutely free. Find out more online at purebulk.com.
The Animal Farm Radio Show.
Now they're bleaching bread to look like multigrain, so you have to brown.
Yeah, get your ugly white ass out.
Weeknights from 5 to 7 p.m. Central.
Welcome back, everybody. We're talking about the public education training generations for slavery. And we left off in Puritan colonial America about how the Puritans were the impetus for universal government-sponsored education. And Massachusetts passed a law requiring that every child be taught to read. Well, in 1647, Massachusetts passed the Old Deluder Satan Act, so named because its purpose was to defeat Satan's attempt to keep men, through their inability to read, from knowledge of the scriptures. The law required every town of 50 or more families to establish an elementary school and every town of 100 or more families to maintain a grammar school as well. Puritan or not, virtually all colonial schools had clear-cut moral purposes. Skills and knowledge were considered important to the degree that they serve religious ends and, of course, train the mind. Well, in the 18th century, as the spirit of science, commercialism, secularism, and individualism quickened in the Western world, education in the colonies was called upon to satisfy the practical needs of seamen, merchants, artisans, and frontiersmen. The effect of these new developments on curriculum in American schools was more immediate and widespread than its effect in European schools. Practical content was soon competing vigorously with religious concerns. The academy that Ben Franklin helped found in 1751 was the first of a growing number of secondary schools that sprang up in competition with the Latin schools. Franklin's academy continued to offer the humanist religious curriculum, but it also brought education closer to the needs of everyday life by teaching such courses as history, geography, merchant accounts, geometry, algebra, surveying, modern languages, navigation, and astronomy. By the mid-19th century, this new diversification in the curriculum characterized virtually all American secondary education. After the Revolutionary War, new textbooks, mostly American histories and geographies, began to appear. Often they were written with this strong nationalistic flavor, of course. Also, beginning in 1783, the New England Primer began to share its supremacy with what was to become an even more popular school book, Noah Webster's American Spelling Book. This work standardized American spelling and emancipated it from English spelling, which, of course, is why we do not say aluminium. It also exposed American school children to more than a century of grueling drill. The speller was used until the end of the 19th century, but the stress on spelling accuracy and the spelling bee craze continued to grip schools into the early years of the 20th century. In the 19th century, the spirit of nationalism grew strong in Europe, and with it the belief of the power of education to shape the future of nations as well as individuals. Other European countries followed Prussia's example and eventually established national school systems. France had one by the 1880s, and by the 1890s, the primary schools in England were free and compulsory. The attitude towards women, too, was slowly changing. By the last half of the 19th century, both France and Germany had established secondary schools for women. Only the most liberal educators, however, had entertained the notion of co-education. By and large, European elementary schools in the 19th century were much like those of the 16th, 17th, and 18th century. They were attended by children of lower classes until, at the latest, by age 10 or 11, when schooling terminated for all but a few of the brightest among them. Usual subjects, reading, writing, religion, and if the teacher had mastered it himself, arithmetic. Teacher was often poorly informed. Frequently, he taught because he was unable to get any other kind of work. And to interject here, that is why we have that phrase that says, those who can, do. Those who cannot, teach. That's where that came from. School might be held in an apprentice shops, industrial plants, living rooms, kitchens, or outdoor areas, though regular classrooms were becoming the rule. If the teacher could maintain order at all, it was by bullying, beating, and ridiculing the children. Perhaps the best description of the children who attended such schools is by the English novelist Charles Dickens. Pale and haggard-faced, lank and bony figures, children with the countenances of old men. There was childhood with the light of its eyes quenched, its beauty gone, and its helplessness alone remaining. It's no wonder, then, that Johann Heinrich Pestalozzi's school at Yverdon, Switzerland, created international attention and attracted thousands of European and American visitors. What they saw was a school for children, real children, not miniature adults. They saw physically active children running, jumping, and playing. They saw small children learning the names of numbers by counting real objects and preparing to learn to read by playing with letter blocks. They saw older children engaged in object lessons, progressing in their study of geography from observing the area around the school to measuring it to making their own relief maps of it, and finally seeing a professionally executed map of it. This was the school, and these were the methods developed by Pestalozzi in accordance with his belief that the goal of education should be the natural development of the individual child, and that educators should focus on the development of the child rather than on memorization of subject matter that he was unable to understand. Pestalozzi's school also mirrored the idea that learning begins with firsthand observation of the object and moves gradually towards the remote and abstract realm of worlds and ideas. The teacher's job is to guide, not distort, the natural growth of the child by selecting his experiences and directing those experiences toward the realm of ideas. The German philosopher and psychologist Johann Friedrich Herbert's education was neither the training of faculties that exist ready-made for the mind, nor the natural unfolding from within. Education was instruction, literally the building into the mind from the outside. The building blocks were the materials of instruction, the subject matter. The builder was the teacher. Is anyone listening to certain code words in here? The psychology on which Herbert based his teaching methods was later proved incorrect. His systemized lesson plans, however, guiding the teacher in what he considered the proper manner and sequence of presenting subject matter to pupils, was the real innovation in education. by denying that the man mind consists of inborn faculties that can be exercised on any kind of material, Herbert drew the attention of educators to the subject matter itself, to the content of the material. He took the emphasis off memorizing, at least in theory, and put it on understanding. He also transformed the image of the teacher. No longer an ignorant bully beating knowledge into the children, the teacher became a person trained in effective methods of imparting knowledge. He controlled the learning situation through psychological insight, not physical force. The teacher inspired the child's interest in the material because he knew how to present it. Herbert's goal, educational goal, was different than Pestalozzi's, however, and his teaching methods created a different kind of school. Herbert was working within the framework of state-controlled school system. For him, the goal of education was to create individuals who are part of the socio-political community. Herbert's teachers built knowledge into the child's mind through a systematic method of instruction that was uniform for all pupils. Thus, the instruction in Europe and the United States that was influenced by Herbert's theories was the teacher and curriculum-centered. That influenced by Pestalozzi's was child-centered. Going to move on quickly to the 19th century, America. America came into its own educationally with the movement towards state-supported secular free schools for all children, which began in the 1820s with the common or elementary school. The movement gained impetus in 1837 when Massachusetts established a state board of education and appointed the lawyer and politician Horace Mann as its secretary. Now, many of you out there listening know the name Horace Mann, and I'm sure that you can connect it with some other activities he was involved in. One of Mann's many reforms was the improvement of the quality of teaching by the establishment of the first public normal or teacher training schools in the United States. State after state followed Massachusetts' example until by the end of the 19th century, the common school system was firmly established. It was the first rung of what was to develop into the American educational ladder. After the common school had been accepted, people began to urge that higher education, too, be tax-supported. As early as 1821, the Boston School Committee established the English Classical School, later the English High School, which was the first public secondary school in the United States. By the end of the century, such secondary schools had begun to outnumber the private academies. The original purpose of the American high school was to allow all children to extend and enrich their common school education. With the establishment of land-grant colleges after 1862, the high school also became a preparation for college, a step by which students who had begun at the lowest rung of the educational ladder might reach the highest. In 1873, when the kindergarten became part of St. Louis, Missouri school system, there was a hint that in time a lower rung might be added. Here we're coming up on a break. We'll be right back for the second hour. We're going to get into humanist education and John Dewey and how they have influenced us today. Stay tuned.
Howdy. My name is Chris Milligan, publisher of Trine Day Books. Thomas Jefferson said, "Information is the currency of democracy. Trine Day brings to you what some don't want you to read today." Dr. Mary's Monkey is a book of profound importance that helps us understand what has really happened in our country. Born to write this story, author Ed Haslam had met Dr. Mary Sherman, whose grisly murder mystery led him first to secret medical labs and then into the wilderlands of the Kennedy assassination. Author Jim Mars calls it an eye-opening ride into government cover-ups. Daniel Estulin's award-winning international bestseller, The True Story of the Bilderberg Group, was hailed by editors at a major New York publisher, but then stopped by higher-ups. After you read this book exposing the secret plans of the world's elite, you'll understand why. Trine Day books are available at bookstores everywhere or by calling 1-800-556-2012.
Hey folks, I've got a question for you. Do you force yourself out of bed each morning and drag throughout the day? Do you grab for that sugar pick-me-up only to later crash and feel even more tired? Well, I've got the solution for you. Put a zip in your day and zap your appetite. Reclaim your get-up-and-go with Sip and Zap. Let me tell you what you'll notice in immediate benefits. It ramps up your workouts. well, if you work out, turns off your hunger, elevates your mood, helps you to resist fattening foods, and gives you a smooth flow of energy with no crash. The testimonials? Colin in Illinois lost 30 pounds in 8 weeks, didn't work out. Susie in Missouri, 10 pounds in 20 days, she didn't work out. Anna in California did work out and went from a size 14 to a size 4 in 90 days. If you want results like this, working out or not, order Zip and Zap now and also ask about Lametco International's first line of defense products. Tell them Michael Herzog sent you. Call 1-800-933-2565. That's 1-800-933-2565.
You are now listening to the Oracle Broadcasting Network, the home of cutting-edge talk radio.
And I have noted that with increasing dismay that a number of the predictions which were purely fantastic when I made them 30 years ago have come true or seem in process of coming true. That a number of techniques about which I talk seem to be here already. And that there seems to be a general movement in the direction of this kind of ultimate revolution, this method of control by which people can be made to enjoy a state of affairs which, by any decent standard, they ought not to enjoy. The enjoyment of servitude.
Well, again, what an appropriate quote for our subject matter today. This show is talking about public education training generations for slavery. In the last hour, we are talking about education in America in the 20th century and how it has come along. Well, a new society complicated by the latest discoveries in the physical and biological sciences and rise of industrialism and capitalism calls for newer and newer kinds of knowledge. By 1861, as many as 73 subjects or branches thereof were being offered by the Massachusetts secondary schools. People still believed that the mind could be trained, but they now thought that science could do a better job than the classics. The result was a curriculum that was top-heavy with scientific instruction. In the early days of common schools, like those in Europe, consisted of one room where the teacher taught pupils ranging in age from about 6 to 13 and sometimes older. The teacher instructed the children separately, not as a group. The good teacher had a strong right arm and an unshakable determination to cram information into his pupils. Once the fight to provide free education for all children had been substantially won, educators turned their attention to the quality of that education. To find out more about learning and the learning process, American normal schools turned to Europe. Well, as the country grew, expedience dictated, particularly in the cities, that the one-room common school be replaced by larger schools. To make it easier and faster for one teacher to instruct many students, there has to be as few differences between children as possible. Since the most conspicuous difference was age, children were grouped on this basis, and each group had a separate room. To discourage physical activity that might disrupt discipline and interrupt the teaching process, to encourage close attention to and absorption of the teacher's words, and to increase eye contact, seats were arranged in formal rows. For good measure, they were frequently bolted on the floor. It's not surprising that about this time, when the goal of education was to expedite the transfer of information to a large number of students, that normal schools began to fall under the influence of Herbert. The essence of this influence probably lay not so much in a carefully evolved five-step lesson plan, but in the basic idea of a lesson plan. Such plans suggested the possibility of evolving a systematic method of instruction that was the same for all pupils. This new method, combined with the physical organization of the school, represented the antithesis of Pestalozzi's belief that the child's innate power should be allowed to unfold naturally. Rather, the child must be lopped off or stretched to fit the procrustean curriculum bed. Subjects were graded according to difficulty, assigned to certain years, and taught by a rigid daily timetable. The amount of information that the child had absorbed through drill and memorization was determined by how much could be extracted from him by examination. Reward or punishment came in the form of grades. At the end of the 19th century, the methods of presenting information had thus been streamlined. Psychological flogging in the form of grades had perhaps diminished the amount of physical flogging. In one respect, however, the schools of the late 19th century were no different from those, say, of the Middle Ages. They were still based on what adults thought children were or should be, not what they really are. Well, I hope that that has given you an idea of where we have come from, how the philosophy has switched from one end of the spectrum to the other and back again, and now here we are again. And when we're going through the Renaissance period, I asked everyone to pay attention to the fact that it was a humanist curriculum. Well, we are going to talk about humanism and humanists on the other side of this short break coming up. This is a short segment. Those of you listening on the stream or in the archives, stay tuned because we will be back and we will get into how what humanism actually is, what they say themselves it is, and how they have affected education today.
You invest, you buy insurance, you wear your seatbelt, you do things to ensure your family's future and protection. But why? Just in case? With the current state of affairs, ask yourself, am I ready? Preparation starts at SurvivalGearSource.com. SurvivalGearSource.com has a huge selection of vital products, emergency survival kits, gas masks, MREs, products for pet care, your car, home, office, and school. Protect against pandemics, all natural disasters, and terror attacks that can happen at any time. If you're not prepared, the last place you want to be is standing in a FEMA line. Invest in your future now. Visit SurvivalGearSource.com or call 877-231-1925. That's 877-231-1925. SurvivalGearSource.com. That's SurvivalGearSource.com. 877-231-1925. SurvivalGearSource.com. Prepare for tomorrow now, and for a free gift on your first order, enter coupon code ORACLE at checkout. Don't forget, preparation starts at SurvivalGearSource.com.
Hey folks, it's Tony Pax from the Animal Farm Radio Show, and I want to tell you about the company Totally Wicked. Totally Wicked is the leading online worldwide supplier of electronic cigarettes. An electronic cigarette, or e-cigarette, is an alternative to smoked tobacco products such as cigarettes, cigars, or pipes. It is a battery-powered device that provides inhaled doses of nicotine by delivering a vaporized liquid nicotine solution. In addition to nicotine delivery, this vapor also provides a flavor and physical sensation similar to that of inhaled tobacco smoke, even though no tobacco smoke or combustion is actually involved in its operation. Totally Wicked's products not only help a person to regulate their nicotine intake and creates a vapor resembling smoke, but it also looks like a cigarette, thereby helping the user with the psychological and physical habit of holding a regular cigarette. To find out more about the great products that Totally Wicked has to offer, please visit totallywicked-eliquid.com or email them at info@totallywicked-eliquid.com.
How would you like to cook any meal using no electricity or gas and cook your meals off the grid? Well, now you can, thanks to the Survival Oven. The Survival Oven is the most amazing off-grid solar oven that can cook anything that a conventional oven can without the energy bills. By condensing sunlight, the Survival Oven can produce temps up to 350 degrees, cook delicious and nutritious meals, sterilize water, dehydrate food, and so much more, all at zero operating costs. The Survival Oven can be used year-round, even in the coldest sub-zero temperatures, and is a must for emergency preparedness and even everyday use. Visit SurvivalOven.com to get your very own Survival Oven. Order the Survival Oven now, and we'll get you started with two cooking pots and a recipe booklet absolutely free. At less than 10 pounds, you can take Survival Solar Oven with you anywhere. Call 877-642-1553 or go to SurvivalOven.com. That's SurvivalOven.com.
I wrote 30 years ago of a fable that Brave New World, which is essentially the account of a society making use of all the devices at their time available, and some of the devices which I imagine to be possible, making use of them in order to, first of all, standardize the population, to iron out inconvenient human differences, to create, so to say, mass-produced models of human beings arranged in some kind.
Welcome back, everybody. Hour two of the Iconoclast with Carolyn Harris, and we're talking about public education, training the generations for slavery. In the last hour, I really wanted to give everyone a history of where education has come from, how it has progressed through the ages, and how we got to where we are. But now we're going to talk about humanism and what they believe, what they're all about, and how they have affected education today. going to be reading from a document entitled Humanistic Morals and Values Education by Vince Nesbitt. And that is, of course, located on my website, the library on my website, I should say. And you can get there by going to www.nwolibrary.com. Click on the library button, and the documents I'm citing are located in Public Education, Dumbing Down the Masses. Document says, referring to humanism, the term is misleading. It refers not to humane education, nor to education in the humanities, but to education according to the principles of secular humanism. Secular humanism is an elitism proposing some quite inhumane solutions to social problems, abortion, infanticide, assisted suicide, mercy killing. Dylan McCarthy notes that, quote, the misappropriation of that name, humanism, by atheists was a masterpiece of psychological semantics, end quote. I have to agree. Professor J. Charles Park of the University of Wisconsin makes an interesting distinction, explained in the National Educator. When education exists to train people to accept time-honored truths, to understand the difference between right and wrong, that is traditional education. When education exists, quote, to create independent thinking, that is humanistic education. The principles of secular humanism are clearly exposed in Humanist Manifesto 1, published in 1933, and Humanist Manifesto 2, published in 1973. These should be read fully by all who wish to understand, and perhaps especially by those who promote humanistic education. Now, here are a few excerpts that may help to understand the general thrust. This is from the Humanist Manifesto 1. Though it refers to religious humanism and religious humanists, this manifesto denies the existence of God or the Creator. Quote, we are convinced that the time has passed for theism, deism. Religious, and quoting from the document, religious humanists regard the universe as self-existing and not created, end quote. This life for a humanist is all there is. Quote, religious humanism considers the complete realization of human personality to be the end of a man's life and seeks its development and fulfillment in the here and now. Man will learn to face crises in life in terms of his knowledge and their naturalness and probability. Reasonable and manly attitudes will be fostered by education and supported by custom. We assume that humanism will take the path of social and mental hygiene, end quote. Well, I don't know about you, but the term mental hygiene really makes my skin crawl, especially with the recent development in the last few years of what President George Bush Jr. Has. It is an initiative. It's not a law. It is a program called the New Freedom Initiative, and it's all about mental health, and they want to test every human being in the United States to make sure that we're mentally healthy. Well, of course, this will be gauged by whatever it is that they choose, and I would assume that they are humanist ideals. Now, to the Humanist Manifesto 2, it says, as in 1933, humanists still believe that traditional theism, especially faith and the prayer-hearing God, assumed to love and care for persons, to hear and understand their prayers, and to be able to do something about them, is an unproved and outmoded faith. We begin with humans, not God, nature, not deity. Humans are responsible for what we are or will become. No deity will save us. We must save ourselves. We affirm that moral values derive their source from human experience. Ethics is autonomous and situational, needing no theological or ideological sanction. Ethics stem from human needs and interests. The right to birth control, abortion, and divorce should be recognized. We do not approve of exploitative, denigrating forms of sexual expression, neither do we wish to prohibit by law or sanction sexual behavior between consenting adults. The many varieties of sexual exploration should not in themselves be considered evil. Without countenancing mindless permissiveness or unbridled promiscuity, a civilized society should be a tolerant one. Short of harming others or compelling them to do likewise, individuals should be permitted to express their lifestyles as they desire. A recognition of an individual's right to die with dignity, euthanasia, and the right to suicide. says people are more important than decalogues, rules, proscriptions, or regulations. Innovative and experimental forms of education are to be welcomed. Well, thus is briefly exposed the philosophy of secular humanism, which leads to a belief that man is sufficient unto himself, to selfism, moral autonomy, the primacy of decision over reason, to subjectivism, and the primacy of opinion as the highest degree of certitude attainable. A lot of people talk about relativism, moral relativism, and what that is talking about is this situational ethics. Well, I mean, if that's what you think is right at the time, then that was what's right. Not counting how it affects anyone else, there is no right and wrong. Basically it boils down to the witch or Wiccan of primal rule, which is do what thou wilt. Okay, so do whatever you want. Who cares how it affects anyone else? Well, let's talk about the humanist input into education. Again, reading from that same document, Humanistic Morals and Values Education by Vince Nesbitt. It says, humanistic education began in the USA in the progressive education movement, which dates from about 1905, and its founder is John Dewey, a pragmatist. He says, what works is good. And a humanist, the first president of the American Humanist Society, and a signatory to the Humanist Manifesto I. This lie is aimed to introduce into the United States of America National Socialism, later known in Germany as Nazism, which he called collectivism, and to use schools as the instruments of social change to bring this about. Dewey changed the aim, content, and methods of education in America. In 1905, he organized, along with some Fabians, and we know that those are socialists, the Intercollegiate Socialist Society, which in 1921 changed its name to the League for Industrial Democracy. And this, in turn, formed in 1962 an action arm called Students for a Democratic Society. We can see the evolution of National Socialism throughout the American history right there in one little paragraph. The aim of the League was to put into the classroom teachers, into the pulpit preachers, and into the trade union leaders who were collectivists reflecting the Fabian method. We'll talk more about John Dewey on the other side. Thank you so much for coming up.
Loan modifications don't work, at least not without some leverage from a forensic audit by mortgage fraud examiners. Have your payments skyrocketed under an adjustable rate mortgage? Have you been laid off or had your hours cut? Are balloon payments coming due? Congress and the White House are pinning their hopes on homeowners renegotiating their mortgages to stop the housing crisis. Trouble is, the banks are saying no 80% of the time. That's where Mortgage Fraud Examiners comes in. They perform forensic loan audits and appraisals to find legal deficits in your mortgage. They estimate that up to 85% of all mortgages have legal problems. Banks and lenders suddenly start cooperating if faced with a lawsuit for violating lending laws or appraisal fraud. You could gain some powerful ammunition to use for mortgage fraud examiners. Get more information at www.mortgagefraudexaminers.com or call 800-540-EXAM. That's 800-540-3926.
Now on DVD, my newest documentary film, The Secret Rite, Volume 1. I'm Josh Reeves, and for the almost 2 years, I have researched the secretive right-wing group known as the Council for National Policy. This film explores for the first time the hidden hand that controls the religious and military aims of the American right wing, with such topics as Iran-Contra, the John Birch Society, eugenics, the Vatican controllers, Christian Zionists, the Bohemian Grove, the Patriot Movement, and more. More powerful than the Council on Foreign Relations, more secretive than the Bilderberg Group, The Secret Rite Volume 1 goes where no other film has dared to go. Get your copy today at secretrightmovie.com. That's www.secretrightmovie.com. And find out what you haven't been told about the New World Order.
aerial spraying, chemtrails, the modified atmosphere, heavy metals and pesticides, carcinogens and chemical fibers all falling from the sky. You have a choice to keep your body clean. Detoxify with microplant powder from hempusa.org or call 908-691-2608. It's odorless and tasteless and used in any liquid or food. Protect your family now with microplant powder. Cleaning out heavy metals, parasites, and toxins. Order it now for daily intake and stock it now for long-term storage. Visit hempusa.org or call 908-691-2608 today.
The Animal Farm Radio Show.
This is the greatest show on radio because Paya is on the show.
I know.
Weeknights from 5 to 7 p.m. Central.
The question of how and why the United Nations, the crux of the great conspiracy to destroy the sovereignty of the United States and the enslavement of the American people within a UN one-world dictatorship, is a complete and unknown mystery to the vast majority of the American people. The reason for this unawareness of the frightening danger to our country and to the entire free world is simple. The masterminds behind this great conspiracy have absolute control.
Welcome back. We're talking about John Dewey's contribution to American education. Early in the century, Dewey formed the Progressive Education Association and the American Association of University Professors, also committed to the goal of collectivizing the United States of America. The schools were seen as essential to this task. Quote, "Nothing less than thoroughgoing reconstruction is demanded, and there is no institution known to man that can compass the problem except education," end quote. Implementation of the plan was to be mainly done through social studies, developed chiefly at that time by Dr. George Couts. And regarding social studies, I have done a previous program on community, and I think that was in the Agenda 21 episode. So if you didn't hear that, please go to my website, www.nwolibrary.com, and you can look at all the archives there. Now we're going to read from a document entitled John Dewey in the Chaos of Contemporary Education by Gennady Stolyarov II. The dismal and declining student performance at American public schools is no accident, nor is the pervasive bullying by peers and repression by teachers that the brightest, best-mannered, and most accomplished students encounter in public schools today. Both are the direct result of the education philosophy promulgated by John Dewey, the originator of quote-unquote progressive education and a self-proclaimed advocate of collectivism and opponent of teaching objective knowledge in schools. Dewey's ideas have largely shaped the way in which America's public education system works, or more accurately, does not work. To call Dewey a socialist is no exaggeration or derogatory epithet. It is the literal truth. Dewey read and greatly admired Edward Bellamy's 1887 novel, Looking Backward, which described an egalitarian utopia in which private property was abolished and the capitalist system was a relic of the past. In the 1920s, Dewey wrote extensively in praise of the Soviet education system, so much so that he was invited to visit the Soviet Union in 1928 to observe schools in the USSR. He based many of his recommendations for American education on the Soviet model. Two of Dewey's foremost targets were individualism and objective truth. In his 1920 work, Reconstruction in Philosophy, Dewey vehemently opposed the classic Western idea of the individual as something given, something already there. Consequently, he derided the free capitalistic society where the individual tends to be viewed as something to be catered to, something whose pleasures are to be magnified and possessions multiplied. Instead, Dewey asserted, society is what makes the individual who he is, and social institutions, quote, are not means for obtaining something for individuals, not even happiness. They are means of creating individuals, end quote. So much for the Founding Fathers' conviction that the unalienable or individual rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are primary, and that, quote, to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. For Dewey, Society and government come first. They shape the individuals and make them what they are, and it is ultimately society through government that must decide how each individual is to best serve it. Not only does Dewey's philosophy completely overlook the existence of free will and the possibility of individuals shaping themselves, it also denigrates the pursuit of any kind of knowledge or accomplishment unless society deems it to be useful. In Dewey's words, quote, initiative, inventiveness, varied resourcefulness, assumption of responsibility, and choice of belief and conduct are not absolute, but relative to the use that is to be made of them. And this use varies with the environment, end quote. That is, if society, of course that means whatever group of powerful individuals arrogates to itself the name society, decides that mathematics or science or literature are dangerous or not worth pursuing, then for Dewey, this means that they are dangerous and not worth pursuing. Admirable qualities of individuals, such as resourcefulness or initiative, can also suddenly be declared vices if society sees fit. For Dewey, there is no absolute truth or absolute virtue. Everything changes with the times, is subject to eternal flux, and can be inverted in an instant if the whims of society dictate it. In education, Dewey's view of the primacy of society was translated into the desire to socialize children above all. He wrote, quote, I believe that the social light of the life of the child is the basis of concentration or correlation in all his training or growth. The social life gives the unconscious unity and background of all his efforts and all of his attainments, end quote. In practice, this meant an increasing emphasis on group activities and children spending time around their peers and conforming to those peers' often inane and destructive expectations rather than learning objective facts. Indeed, Dewey greatly discouraged the study of objective facts. He wrote, quote, I believe that we violate the child's nature and render it difficult the best ethical results by introducing the child too abruptly to a number of special studies of reading, writing, geography, etc., out of relation to his social life, end quote. So when we encounter illiterate teenagers or kids who cannot identify China or France on a map, or high school graduates who cannot string a grammatically correct sentence together in their primary language, or college students who must take remedial algebra because they cannot solve a simple linear equation, we are actually seeing what Dewey wanted to happen. Learning reading, writing, mathematics, or geography early sets children apart from their society of peers and inhibits the kind of subjection and conformity that Dewey tried to bring about from an early age. Dewey most detested talented young students who strove to learn as much real knowledge as they could, irrespective of the obstacles placed in their way. He admitted this explicitly when he wrote in, quote, in his book, The School and Society, published 1899, quote, the mere absorption of facts and truths is so exclusively an individual affair that it tends very naturally to pass into selfishness. There is no obvious social motive for the acquirement of mere learning. There is no clear social gain in the success thereat, end quote, because learning objective knowledge empowers the individual and enables him to gain greater heights of accomplishment and virtue. Dewey saw this as a threat to the social engineering he wanted to attain. Anything that did not directly fit into his agenda of top-down control was to be discouraged. And of course, one cannot centrally plan human curiosity, ingenuity, ambition, and desire for self-improvement. These qualities resist Dewey's impulse to create the individual. Thus, the natural implication of Dewey's system was to stifle and suppress such attributes, end quote. Well, now we have to get into what is the actual goal of public education? Well, I'll tell you, it is a scientific society. Just as on one of the bumpers, you hear the quote from Aldous Huxley talking about creating a scientific society where all human differences are ironed out and people are part of the herd. I'm going to read now from a really excellent series entitled The Scientific Outlook. I have condensed parts 1 through 12 by a man named Brent Jessup, who no longer updates his website, but you can find this compendium of his work, The Scientific Outlook, on my website, again, www.nwolibrary.com. Click on the library button. It is in there. This is under the section Education for the Working Class. This document is basically a treatise on what Bertrand Russell wrote when he was talking about a scientific society. Okay, so a lot of these are quotes directly from Bertrand Russell. It says, education has two purposes. On the one hand, to form the mind. On the other hand, to train the citizen. Education in a scientific society may, I think, be best conceived after the analogy of zero of the education provided by the Jesuits. Oh boy, that's a magic word. We'll get right back into it, talk about how the Jesuits educated people. On the other side of this quick break, we'll be right back.
You are now listening to the Oracle Broadcasting Network, the home of cutting-edge talk radio.
Of the 3 million-plus edible food plants that grow on Earth, no other single plant can compare with the nutritional value of the powder, seeds, and oil of the hemp plant. At hempusa.org, we ship worldwide these nutritional products with free shipping to the U.S. and Canada. At hempusa.org, we want to educate our listeners that edible hemp is not marijuana and is certified THC-free. Our powder is 50% protein and does not contain gluten. Gluten impairs the cells from absorbing nutrients. This nutrient-dense food can be stored up to 5 years when vacuum-packed and is priced affordably to be used as a storable food. HempUSA.org is a bulk shipper starting with 5 pounds and up. To allow this food to work for you, call 908-691-2608 or go to HempUSA.org and order today. The body will react and heal itself given the proper nutrition. This superfood will be your greatest asset. So try it today, store it today, and change your life. Call 908-691-2608 or order from hempusa.org.
The First Amendment in the Bill of Rights limits the government's power by ensuring the freedom of speech and preserving the rights of the people. Every day that passes, our rights gradually slip away. It's time to take a stand and let the government know we're tired of losing our rights. LibertyStickers.com will allow you to express your rights and allow millions of people to see you stand up for what you believe in. LibertyStickers.com carries the largest selection of bumper stickers online, ranging from political to humorous, and is your number one source for Ron Paul for President stickers. As always, you can find your favorite stickers that protest the war and the president. Don't see what you're looking for? Liberty Stickers will custom make stickers that will let you get your message across for all Americans to see. Go to LibertyStickers.com and see pre-made stickers that will get everyone talking. That's LibertyStickers.com or call 877-873-9626. Liberty Stickers, the world's most dangerous stickers.
Are you one of the people who think, I have plenty of time, nothing's ever going to happen bad to me? Do you believe that when your cupboards are bare, our corporate-controlled government will jump right in to feed you and yours? Do you have at least a year's supply of food for your family? This is Kurt, the armchair survivalist, heard on this network. Survival Enterprises sells real food, canned for long-term storage. Beef, chicken, turkey, bacon, butter, cheese, eggs, freeze-dried fruits and vegetables, Mountain House freeze-dried meals, MREs, a full nutritional line, the British Birkfeld water filter, and more. If you want to prepare now, go to beforeitstoolate.us. That's beforeitstoolate.us. Or call 1-800-753-1981. That's 1-800-753-1981. Or you can put your head in the sand and be just another sheeple in the corporate-controlled flock. But remember, those who don't learn from history are bound to repeat it.
There's something else going on here, and they haven't told you the whole story. You are the stock in the corporation, so they give your body to the bank in Switzerland. So your body now becomes stock for the corporation, so you make it safe, because you are a moneymaker.
Welcome back, everybody. We're going to jump right back into it. We are reading from a document called The Scientific Outlook by Brent Jessup, talking about the writings of Sir Bertrand Russell, who was also formative in education. We left off talking about how education in scientific society is best conceived after the analogy of the education provided by the Jesuits. The Jesuits provided one sort of education for the boys who were to become ordinary men of the world, and another for those who were to become members of the Society of Jesus. In like manner, the scientific rulers will provide one kind of education for ordinary men and women, and another for those who are to become holders of scientific power. Ordinary men and women will be expected to be docile, industrious, punctual, thoughtless, and contented. Of these qualities, probably contentment will be considered the most important. In order to produce it, all the researches of psychoanalysis, behaviorism, biochemistry will be brought into play. Children will be educated from their earliest years in the manner which is found least likely to produce complexes. Almost all will be normal, happy, healthy boys and girls. Their diet will not be left to the caprices of their parents, but will be such as the best biochemists recommend. Of course, I have to interject here. It is the best that certain biochemists recommend, and that is, of course, junk food, a very high caloric intake, lots and lots of carbs, lots of FD&C Red number 40, aspartame, and anything that's bad for you, fluoride that helps calcify your pineal gland. So that is actually happening already. He says they will spend much time in the open air and will be given no more book learning than is absolutely necessary. Upon the temperament so formed, docility will be imposed by the methods of drill sergeant, or perhaps the softer methods employed by Boy Scouts. All the boys and girls will learn from an early age to be what is called cooperative, i.e., to do exactly what everybody is doing. Initiative will be discouraged in these children, and insubordination without being punished will be scientifically trained out of them. Well, again, to interject, no, that is not being trained out of them. They're just being drugged. Soma, here we come. We already have Ritalin and all of the other associated nasty pharmacological creations, so they're just being drugged to be docile. It says their education thought will be in great part manual, and when their school years come to an end, they will be taught a trade. In deciding what trade they are to adopt, experts will appraise their aptitudes, and guess why we have all those little aptitude testing in schools. Yes, all that information goes into a database, and you are going to be channeled in a certain direction. The giving of these formal lessons, insofar as they exist, will be conducted by means of the cinema or radio, so that one teacher can give simultaneous lessons in all the classes throughout the whole country. The giving of these lessons, of course, will be recognized as a highly skilled undertaking reserved for the members of the governing class. Well, we don't have that in regular public indoctrination centers known as public schools, but does anybody recognize that this is what's happening with the Phoenix Online University? It's already started. So as for the manual workers, they will be discouraged from serious thought. They will be made as comfortable as possible, and their hours of work will be much shorter than they are at present, which is obviously not happening. They will have no fear of destitution or misfortune to their children. As soon as working hours are over, amusements will be provided, or a sort calculated to cause wholesome mirth and to prevent any thoughts of discontent which otherwise might cloud their happiness. Well, you know, we have lots and lots of breads and circuses for the masses. He goes on those rare occasions when a boy or girl is past the age at which it is usual to determine the social status, shows such marked ability as to seem the intellectual equal of the rulers, a difficult situation will arise, requiring serious consideration. If the youth is content to abandon his previous associates and to throw in his lot wholeheartedly with the rulers, he may, after suitable tests, be promoted. But if he shows any regrettable solidarity with his previous associates, that is, us unwashed masses, the rulers will reluctantly conclude that there is nothing to be done with him except send him to the lethal chamber before his ill-disciplined intelligence has had time to spread revolt. This will be a painful duty to the rulers, but I think they will not shrink from performing it. So if you didn't quite get that, yes, they plan to kill you if you are intelligent and you don't join the ruling class. Now, let's talk about education for the ruling class. Bertrand Russell says those children, on the other hand, who are destined to become members of the governing class will have a very different education. They will be selected, some before birth, and during the first 3 years of their life, and a few between the ages of 3 and 6. All the best-known science will be applied to the simultaneous development of intelligence and willpower. Eugenics, chemical and thermal treatment of the embryo and diet in early years will be used with a view to the production of the highest possible ultimate ability. The scientific outlook will be instilled from the moment that a child can talk, and throughout the early impressionable years, the child will be carefully guarded from contact with the ignorant and unscientific. From infancy up to 21, scientific knowledge will be poured into him, and at any rate from the age of 12 upwards, he will specialize in those sciences for which he shows most aptitude. At the same time, he will be taught physical toughness. He will be encouraged to roll naked in the snow, to fast occasionally for 24 hours, to run many miles on hot days, to be bold in all physical adventures and uncomplaining when he suffers physical pain. Gee, that sounds like the Hitler Youth, doesn't it? Continuing on, from the age of 12 upwards, he will be taught to organize children slightly younger than himself, and he will suffer severe censure if groups of such children fail to follow his lead. A sense of his high destiny will be constantly set before him, and loyalty towards his order will be so axiomatic that it will never occur to him to question it. Every youth will be thus subjected to threefold training, in intelligence, in self-command, and in commands over others. If he should fail in any one of these, he will suffer the terrible penalty of degradation to the ranks of the common workers and will be considered for the rest of his life to associate with men and women vastly inferior to himself in education and probably in intelligence. The spur of this fear will suffice to produce industry in all but a very small minority of boys and girls for the governing class. Except for the one matter of loyalty to the world state and to their own order, members of the governing class will be encouraged to be adventurous and full of initiative. It will be recognized that it is their business to improve the scientific technique and to keep the manual workers contented by means of new continual amusements. As those upon whom all progress depends, they must not be unduly tame, nor drilled so as to be incapable of new ideas. Unlike children destined to be manual workers, they will have personal contact with their teacher and will be encouraged to argue with him. It will be his business to prove himself in the right if he can, and if not, to acknowledge his error gracefully. There will, however, be limits to intellectual freedom, even among the children of the governing class. They will not be allowed to question the value of science or the division of population into manual workers and experts. They will not be allowed to coquette with the idea that perhaps poetry is as valuable as machinery or love as good a thing as scientific research. And if such ideas do occur to any venturesome spirit, they will be received in pained silence, and there will be a pretense that they have not been heard. A profound sense of public duty will be instilled into boys and girls of the governing class as soon as they are able to understand such an idea. They will be taught to feel that mankind depends upon them and that they owe benevolent service especially to the less fortunate classes beneath them. But let it not be supposed that they will be prigs. Far from it. They will turn off with deprecating laugh any too portentous remark that puts into explicit words what they will all believe in their hearts. Their manners will be easy and pleasant, and their sense of humor unfailing. In normal cases, children of sufficiently excellent heredity will be admitted to the governing class from the moment of conception. I start with this moment rather than birth, since it is from this moment, not merely from the moment of birth, that the treatment of the two classes will be different. If, however, by the time the child reaches the age of 3, if it is fairly clear that he does not attain the required standard, he will be degraded at that point. I assume by that time it will be possible to judge the intelligence of a child of 3 with a fair measure of accuracy. Now, let's talk about education of the priestly class. Oh, yes, oh, yes. The latest stage in the education of the most intellectual of the governing class will consist of training for research. Research will be highly organized, and young people will not be allowed to choose what particular piece of research they shall do. They will, of course, be directed to research in those subjects for which they have shown special ability. A great deal of scientific knowledge will be concealed from all but a few. There will be arcane research reserved for a priestly class of researchers who will be carefully selected for their combination of brains with loyalty. We'll be right back for the last segment of the Iconoclast Report. Stay tuned.
How would you like to finally be debt-free without paying another cent to creditors and not have to file bankruptcy? DebtCrisisSolutions.com can help free you from the debt trap. This is not a debt settlement program which has tax consequences or debt consolidation. With our program, there are no more payments to creditors or collectors. We will help restore your credit history, protect your property, prevent paycheck garnishments, and preserve your bank account. We also provide mortgage modification services which can lower your mortgage payments without refinancing. If you're facing foreclosure or are in the foreclosure process, we can help. Finally, proven debt solutions that work for the people. Become debt-free in 90 days. Doing nothing doesn't make the debt go away. Call Debt Crisis Solutions today and speak to an advisor absolutely free. Call 718-615-0123. That's 718-615-0123. Or visit them online at DebtCrisisSolutions.com. That's DebtCrisisSolutions.com today.
PureBulk.com has more than 120 nutritional products, super antioxidants, amino acids, and herbal extracts, including advanced life extension nutrition. Find great products like atomic iodine, oil of oregano, spirulina algae, niacin, performance amino acids, herbal extracts, skincare, and heart health nutrition. PureBulk.com products have no fillers, no additives, no hype, and no fancy retail packaging. Just the highest quality bulk nutrition at wholesale pricing. You can also save 50 to 90% off retail nutritional prices when buying bulk wholesale powders and capsules. Shop securely online at purebulk.com or call 406-251-3270. That number again, 406-251-3270. Use the coupon code iodine and receive a 1 gram atomic iodine sample with any order. That's a 150-day RDA supply of atomic iodine absolutely free. Find out more online at purebulk.com.
Howdy. My name is Chris Milligan, publisher of Trine Day Books. Thomas Jefferson said, information is the currency of democracy. Trine Day brings you what some don't want you to read today. Dr. Mary's Monk is a book of profound importance. It helps us understand what has really happened in our country. Born to write this story, author Ed Haslam had met Dr. Mary Sherman, whose grisly murder mystery led him first to secret medical labs and then into the wilderlands of the Kennedy assassination. Author Jim Mars calls it an eye-opening ride into government cover-ups. Daniel Estulin's award-winning international bestseller, The True Story of the Bilderberg Group, was hailed by editors at a major New York publisher, but then stopped by higher-ups. After you read this book exposing the secret plans of the world's elite, you'll understand why. Trine Day books are available at bookstores everywhere or by calling 1-800-556-2012.
Exploring the matrix of consciousness is Esoteric Action Radio, Sundays from 9 to 11 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Only on our broadcast.
The nature of the ultimate revolution with which we are now faced is precisely this, that we are in process of developing a whole series of techniques which will enable the controlling oligarchies that have always existed and presumably always will exist. Get people actually to love their search. This seems to me the ultimate in malevolent revolution.
Well, how timely. We're talking about exactly that, the controlling oligarchy, the education of the priestly class. Okay. We're talking about how the education for the priestly class, those students will be directed towards specific research that is decided for them. Well, he says, I think the subject which will be of most importance politically is mass psychology. Mass psychology is, scientifically speaking, not a very advanced study. This study is immensely useful to practical men, whether they wish to become rich or to acquire the government. It is, of course, as a science, founded upon individual psychology, but hitherto it has employed rule of thumb methods that were based upon a kind of intuitive common sense. Its importance has been enormously increased by the growth of modern methods of propaganda. Of these, the most influential is what is called education. Religion plays a part, though a diminishing one. The press, the cinema, and the corporate-controlled radio play an increasing part. And quoting Bertrand Russell, of course, here we are, education today. Oh, my goodness. Well, let's talk about how, very quickly, the mental engineering, okay, that they are trying to create. Again, quoting from a document, Humanistic Morals and Values Education. It says, in the USA, a new definition of education has appeared, behavioral change. That term appeared in the journal to the National Education Association in 1969. Education in schools, as they exist today, will change drastically during the 1970s and will be modified almost beyond recognition by the end of the century. The basic role of the teacher will change noticeably. 10 years hence, it should be more accurate to term him a learning clinician, intended to convey the idea that schools are becoming clinics to provide individualized psychosocial treatment for the student, thus increasing both value to himself and society. Now, the concept broadens the classroom, the notion of the child as mentally ill or the teacher as the healer. Yes. Okay. Okay, we have some quotes that I will read very quickly. John Dewey, personal independence often makes an individual so insensitive in his relations to others as to develop the illusion of being really able to stand alone and act alone, an unnamed form of insanity. Paul Brandwin, any child who believes in God is mentally ill. Ashley Montague, the American family structure produces mentally ill children. Dr. Pierce of Harvard University, every child in America who enters school at the age of 5 is mentally ill because he comes to school with allegiance toward our elected officials, toward our founding fathers, toward our institutions, toward the preservation of this form of government we have. Patriotism, nationalism, sovereignty. All of that proves the child's children are sick because truly well individual is one who has rejected all of those things and is what I would call the true international child of the future. The National Training Laboratories run by the National Education Association, and now I talked about them last week about Tavistock and the Delphi Technique, and if you didn't hear that, please go back in the archives so you will know why this is so important. Explains the use of psychiatric methods on children who are mentally ill aside from the above definitions of mental illness. Quote, although they appear to behave appropriately and seem normal by most cultural standards, they may actually be in need of mental health care in order to help them change, adapt, and conform to the planned society in which there will be no conflict of attitudes or beliefs. The Humanist Manifesto 1, you will recall, in its 11th affirmation states, quote, we assume that humanism will take the path of social and mental hygiene. How is this mental illness to be so remedied? We have seen that evolution change from a basic part of humanist philosophy, so humanistic is devoted to change. Carl Rogers puts it bluntly, quote, the goal of education is the facilitation of change. Yes. Teachers as change agents, okay? A change agent has been described by Barbara M. Morris as, quote, a person, organization, or institution that changes or helps to change the beliefs, values, attitudes, or behavior of people without their knowledge or consent, end quote. When children enter school, the change agent must find out, quote, where they are at so that appropriate measures can be taken to bring them to the targeted where they ought to be. Quote, in a sense, teachers are social engineers, but it cannot be done without the previous steps of discovery and diagnosis as well of goal setting. This assessment having been made, the child's behavior must be changed as rapidly as possible while the mind is most plastic to change. Quote, the basic personality patterns may have been formed before children enter school. They can be changed, but the later that it is postponed, the more difficult it is the process. The difficulty of changing the child as this age advances from the personality pattern conferred by parents and home has led to pressure for access to children at an ever-decreasing age, from 2 years old to 18 months, when the brain is growing faster than it ever will and is then also more plastic and more available for appropriate experiences and corrective interventions. Now, that this is from the report of the president from the White House conference, which met in D.C., December 1970, quote, a daycare program that ministers to a child from 6 months to 6 years has over 8,000 hours to teach him values, fears, beliefs, and behaviors. The Joint Commission on Mental Health referred to above proposed that, quote, the child advocate, psychologist, social technician, and medical technician should all reach aggressively into the community, send workers out to children's homes, recreational facilities, and schools, assume full responsibility for all education, including pre-primary education, parent education, and community education. Every child and youth in America from conception through age 24 are to be included. Now, what all of this is about is programming responses. And now, the techniques of behavioral change, such as sensitivity training, role-playing, and psychodrama and sociodrama, are introduced into the classroom for handling disruptive youth. Then they became extended to every child. This is developed, of course, by psychiatrists and psychologists. These are the powerful tools designed to produce change in attitudes and behavior through programming responses. Children are subjected to mental stress through emotional involvement with clear risks of psychological damage. Individual values may be exchanged for group values, and family alienation can result. Well, guess what, everybody? That is exactly the point. Public education is all about social engineering, mental engineering. It is a way to control everyone. Everyone alive today has been through public education unless they were gratefully homeschooled. I choose to homeschool because I am not subjecting my child to this inculcation of the subjective values, situational ethics, and humanistic ideas that the government wants everyone to believe. And, of course, there are people behind the government that pull their strings too. But yes, don't program me, bro. Exactly. I do not want to be programmed. I don't watch television. Don't let my child watch television. We choose what we put in our brains, not someone else. And if you are listening today and your child is in public school, I really encourage you to look up these documents in my library, www.nwolibrary.com. Click on the library button and look under public education. Look under the social engineering section. There are a lot of documents there. And please, please look into homeschooling. One of the disinformation techniques is to convince people that, well, you have to be highly educated in order to homeschool your child. You know what? You don't. There are curricula out there that you can purchase. There are many different methods of homeschooling, from the regular, rigid, daily curriculum all the way to the other end of the spectrum called unschooling, where the child directs his own learning. And you know what? Different methods work best with different children and different personalities. Of my little child, who would be going into first grade, is in second and third grade subjects on certain matters. She knows more than high school students about certain things. Why? Because we use everyday things to learn, and you can too. And parents out there, you have a responsibility, and please take that very seriously. We'll see you back here next week, same bat time, same bat channel, for another episode of the Iconoclast Report, U.S. Multiple Broadcasting Network. Take care.
Hey folks, I've got a question for you. Do you force yourself out of bed each morning and drag throughout the day? Do you grab for that sugar pick-me-up only to later crash and feel even more tired? Well, I've got the solution for you. Put a zip in your day and zap your appetite. Reclaim your get-up-and-go with Zip and Zap. Let me tell you what you'll notice in immediate benefits. It ramps up your workouts. Well, if you work out. turns off your hunger, elevates your mood, helps you to resist fattening foods, and gives you a smooth flow of energy with no crash. The testimonials? Colin in Illinois lost 30 pounds in 8 weeks, didn't work out. Susie in Missouri, 10 pounds in 20 days, she didn't work out. Anna in California did work out and went from a size 14 to a size 4 in 90 days. If you want results like this, working out or not, order Zip and Zap now and also ask about Lametco International's first line of defense products. Tell them Michael Herzog sent you. Call 1-800-933-2565. That's 1-800-933-2565.
You invest. You buy insurance. You wear your seatbelt. You do things to ensure your family's future and protection. But why? Just in case? With the current state of affairs, ask yourself, am I ready? Preparation starts at SurvivalGearSource.com. SurvivalGearSource.com has a huge selection of vital products, emergency survival kits, gas masks, MREs, products for pet care, your car, home, office, and school. Protect against pandemics, all natural disasters, and terror attacks that can happen at any time. If you're not prepared, the last place you want to be is standing in a FEMA line. Invest in your future now. Visit SurvivalGearSource.com or call 877-231-1925. That's 877-231-1925. SurvivalGearSource.com. That's SurvivalGearSource.com. 877-231-1925. SurvivalGearSource.com. Prepare for tomorrow now, and for a free gift on your first order, enter coupon code ORACLE at checkout. Don't forget, preparation starts at SurvivalGearSource.com.
As America limps on its lost legs, a pillar of truth has risen. You're listening to the Oracle Broadcasting Network.